Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Let's get right to it with the public health news and research roundup.
Attention listeners, as per the WAKT Pro Bono Legal Department, please note that this public health news and research roundup has no affiliation with the herbicide Roundup, which is a registered trademark of Monsanto. Also, please note that, unlike the herbicide Roundup, this public health news and research Roundup is not a known human carcinogen.
First up, drum roll please. Monsanto spent $17 million in 1 year to discredit International Cancer Agency over glyphosate classification. This from SustainablePulse.com. How badly did Monsanto want to discredit international cancer scientists who found the company's glyphosate herbicide to be a probable human carcinogen and promote a counter message of glyphosate safety instead? Badly enough to allocate about $17 million for the mission in just 1 year alone, according to evidence obtained by lawyers representing cancer victims suing Monsanto. It has been 4 years since the International Agency for Research on Cancer, the IARC, reviewed and published peer-reviewed scientific literature regarding glyphosate and found the herbicide to be probably carcinogenic, with a particular association to non-Hodgkin lymphoma. IARC is part of the World Health Organization and has classified over 1,000 substances as to their cancer hazard, typically without too much controversy. But glyphosate was different. Following the March 2015 classification, hundreds and then thousands of people diagnosed with non-Hodgkin lymphoma after exposures to Monsanto's herbicides filed suit against the agrochemical giant. Also, immediately after the IARC classification of glyphosate, and continuing to this day, the cancer scientists became the subject of sweeping condemnation from an assortment of organizations, individuals, and even some U.S. lawmakers. They have been accused of operating not on sound science, but on behalf of a political agenda, cherry-picking data, and promoting junk science, among other things. The criticisms have been magnified and repeated around the world in news articles, opinion pieces, blogs, internet, Google advertisements, and more. Internal Monsanto documents that have surfaced through discovery for the more than 11,000 lawsuits filed against the company show that, among other tactics, Monsanto has been secretly using third parties for its anti-IARC messaging because company executives and public relation agents thought the information would appear more credible coming from entities separate from Monsanto. No kidding. Okay, now some news with a local angle. From EWG.org, investigation. Manure from unregulated factory farms fuels Lake Erie's toxic algae blooms. Nutrient-rich pollution runs off previously undocumented operations into Maumee River watershed. Unregulated animal factory farms are funneling nutrient-rich pollution into Lake Erie, feeding an enormous toxic algae bloom each summer, according to a new investigation by the Environmental Working Group and the Environmental Law and Policy Center. By analyzing aerial photos, satellite imagery, and state permit data, the groups identified 775 hog, cattle, dairy, and poultry operations in the Maumee River watershed in Ohio, Indiana, and Michigan in 2018, a 40% increase since 2005. The investigation found that more than a fourth of factory farms in the watershed had expanded since they were built, and at least half the manure generated along the Ohio portion of the river comes from operations that lack state permits. Until now, no one knew how many industrial animal farms are in the Maumee River watershed. Manure from animal factory farms is rich in nutrients like phosphorus, which triggers the growth of toxic algae blooms. 3/4 of the watershed is in Ohio. Farmers in Ohio don't need permits for small and medium-sized animal farms, which can house thousands of animals, exempting them from guidelines about how to manage animal manure. Ohio must finally set a legal limit for the amount of phosphorus industrial farms can release into waterways and create a concrete plan to achieve the needed reductions, said Madeline Fleischer, senior attorney in Ohio for the Environmental Law and Policy Center. Millions of people in the Great Lakes region are tired of watching regulators and lawmakers continue to spend money just to kick that can down the road. In the absence of permits, policymakers are basically making blind decisions about how to best manage animal factory farms and the pollution they create. As long as that gaping loophole exists, lasting cleanup of Lake Erie and other waterways is incredibly unlikely. In the absence of meaningful regulations protecting Lake Erie, residents of Toledo, Ohio recently approved a ballot measure granting the water body the same rights as people, which will allow citizens to sue on its behalf. The Ohio Farm Bureau is challenged and it results as unconstitutional. And from Mike Ferner, the coordinator of the Advocates for a Clean Lake Erie, had to say, "This report makes it plain for all to see that the meat, milk, egg factories in our watershed are simply out of control. For 3 years, we've said they produce as much waste as the sewage output from Chicago and Los Angeles. Now we learn it's over twice that amount, just in the Maumee watershed, not the entire western Lake Erie watershed. This industry is using the source of our drinking water as its free toilet. How much longer are we going to allow that to continue?" Very good question. Our next story from BuzzFeed News. People are getting sick from a U.S. steel factory that is grossly violating health standards, experts say. Air pollution has triggered sky-high asthma rates near Pittsburgh. With politicians unwilling to confront U.S. Steel after a factory fire, a county health agency is pushing unprecedented penalties against the $14 billion company. From Clairton, Pennsylvania, here in the deep, steep hills of southwestern Pennsylvania, politicians are struggling to weigh the lives of sick children and elderly people against desperately needed jobs, and mostly, they're choosing the jobs. Ever since a factory fire in late December, pollution alerts have steadily gone out to communities near two U.S. steel plants, one that bakes coal in a massive 2,000-degree oven, and another that flares sulfur-laden gas day and night from a nearby hillside. Steam clouds loft from the smokestacks there in a valley where the asthma rates are nearly triple the national average. Many towns are facing public health consequences of fossil fuels, but Clairton's pollution crisis has unique political stakes. Pitting the behemoth U.S. Steel, a chief beneficiary of President Trump's steel tariffs, against environmentalists and local health officials. In this part of the country, politicians of both parties know that the way to win elections is to win the steel and coal workers. That means that Republicans and even some big-name Democrats seem unwilling to do much about the long-run pollution problem, which is disproportionately hitting young and elderly people, particularly in black communities. This faded town is perched on a hillside above the Monongahela River with some of the dirtiest air in the U.S. With both state and federal regulators absent, environmental groups intend to file a lawsuit against U.S. Steel, and the Allegheny County Health Department has imposed heavy fines and called for shuttering leaking ovens, unprecedented tactics to keep the $14 billion company in check. Not only were they violating the standards, they were grossly violating the standards. The health department fined U.S. Steel $700,000 for continued pollution from its three Mon Valley factories. That was in addition to two fines last year before the fire, a $600,000 fine in October, and a $1 million fine last summer, the largest penalty the county has ever assessed on the company over decades of regulation. U.S. Steel has appealed the June and October fines. claiming in December that fixes could cost $400 million and calling the penalties, quote, arbitrary and capricious. This was all before the Christmas Eve fire, which wiped out sulfur pollution controls there. Since then, the company has continued running the coke works, even with pollution controls knocked out, leaving many residents and progressive local politicians pessimistic that their air in the top 2% for cancer risk from air pollution nationwide will ever get better. This is a classic David versus Goliath battle. They are a county agency fighting with a multinational corporation with every lawyer in town on retainer. Based on census data for the 127,000 people in the 22 towns under the air quality advisory, there are roughly 2,000 kids and 7,000 adults with asthma, as well as 10,000 with heart disease and 7,500 with chronic lung disease. Just upriver from Clareton, about 10 miles away, is the town of Denora, Pennsylvania, where smog deaths from steel and zinc factories in 1948 sparked the first U.S. regulation of air pollution. For 5 days around Halloween of that year, a thick yellow smoke belched from those factories, encasing the town and killing about 20 people. It was the worst air pollution disaster in U.S. history. An investigation led to the first U.S. Air Pollution Conference and eventually the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency and the Clean Air Act. That law is the reason why the air in Mon Valley is much cleaner today, though still among the worst in the country. Well, my friends, the struggle continues to protect our air, water, land, and food from the pollution of corporate profiteering at the expense of yours, mine, and everybody's health. Next up, from The Guardian, a walking conflict of interest. Ex-oil lobbyist confirmed to lead U.S. Interior Department. The Senate has voted to confirm David Bernhardt, a former oil and gas and water lobbyist, as Secretary of the embattled Interior Department. Bernhardt, who was confirmed as Deputy Secretary in July 2017, has been acting Secretary since Ryan Zinke, who was plagued by scandal, stepped down in December. Before joining the administration, Bernhardt worked at a Washington law and lobbying firm on behalf of mining companies, oil and gas giants, and politically powerful Western Water Agency and other groups that have business before the Interior Department. David Bernhardt is a walking conflict of interest who is selling out our public lands to his former clients in the fossil fuel industry, said Michael Brune, executive director of the Sierra Club. Like Ryan Zinke before him, Bernhardt is clearly more interested in doing favors for his corporate polluting friends than in responsibly managing our shared public resources. Enough said. Now for another interesting story from Buffalo News. Lead contamination first found at Customs Gun Range in 2005. Lead contamination issues at the Niagara Gun Range, where more than 600 U.S. Customs agents trained for years, date to 2005, when a federal firearms instructor at the facility was found to have blood lead levels more than 7 times the recommended maximum. Paul Kwiatkowski, president of the union local that represents custom officers in western New York, was enraged that the customs agency allowed the lead contamination issue at the Niagara Gun Range to recur last year, when an inspection found high lead levels from the floor to the microwave to the coffee pot. It shows the agency could care less about their employees. Most bullets are made of lead, and shooting them results in lead dust that can only be controlled with proper ventilation and personal hygiene. Lead exposure can cause anemia and weakness, as well as kidney and brain damage in adults, as well as severe developmental defects in children, according to the Centers for Disease Control. And according to an industrial hygienist report from the Niagara Gun Range last year, one part of the floor was contaminated with lead at a level nearly 167 times higher than OSHA's recommended maximum. If in fact these people were taking their boots home and throwing them on the floor, and you've got like 1-year-old, 2-year-old kid, and they're crawling all over the floor, well, who's getting contaminated now? Well, apparently the moral of this story is that with lead bullets, sometimes the lead kills you real fast, and sometimes the lead kills you real slow. This next story falls under the category of war and public health and the power of vaccines. From AP News, vaccines blocked as deadly cholera raged across Yemen. In the summer of 2017, a plane chartered by the United Nations idled on the tarmac and at an airport in the Horn of Africa as officials waited for final clearance to deliver 500,000 doses of cholera vaccine to Yemen. Amid the country's ruinous war, the disease was spiraling out of control with thousands of new cases reported each day. The green light for the plane to head to northern Yemen never came. The UN wasn't able to distribute cholera vaccines to Yemen until May 2018, and the outbreak ultimately produced more than 1 million suspected cholera cases, the worst cholera epidemic recorded in modern times, and a calamity that medical researchers say may have been avoided if vaccines had been deployed sooner. Well, as I like to say, truth is the first casualty of war. Most of the rest are civilians. The moral of this story, if you care about public health, then you need to have peacemonger in your job description as a planetary citizen. Next up, CDC says nearly 600 cases of deadly drug-resistant fungus reported. This is from The Hill. The CDC has confirmed 587 cases of the fungus Candida auris in 12 states over the past few years. The fungus is a yeast infection with a 1 in 3 mortality rate in cases where the infection reaches the heart, blood, or brain. The disease is spread through medical facilities. It is known to be resistant to at least one class of antifungal drugs, and 1/3 of the strains are resistant to two classes of antifungal drugs, and some strains are resistant to all three classes. And in a related story from Mother Jones Magazine, what's causing an outbreak of the mysterious fungal infection? America's farms offer a clue. Last Saturday, the New York Times came out with an alarming report on Candida auris, a drug-resistant fungal pathogen that has been attacking patients with compromised immune systems in hospitals across the globe. What caught my eye was the possible link, noted in the article, with widespread use of fungicides, chemicals used by farmers worldwide to kill fungi that can harm crops. In recent years, farmers have grown increasingly reliant on a class of fungicides called triazoles, the same chemical used to fight fungal pathogens in humans. Here in the United States, use has spiked since the mid-2000s, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports. Farms and hospitals the world over rely on functionally the same set of chemicals to fight fungal pathogen, those that attack crops and those that attack people. If this sounds familiar, it's because large-scale livestock producers for decades have used antibiotics to make animals grow faster, the very ones doctors need to treat bacterial infections in people, contributing to the rise of deadly antibiotic-resistant pathogens. In recent years, concern over the rise of resistant bacteria has forced meat producers in Europe and the United States to taper their reliance on antibiotics. And another related story from The Hill, the antibiotic market is broken and won't fix itself. Over the past year, we've watched two troubling trends escalate. First, patients increasingly face, and their doctors struggle to treat, infections that do not respond to existing antibiotics. Second, major pharmaceutical companies are backing away from developing new antibiotics. Last July, Novartis became the third major pharmaceutical company in 2018 alone to announce that it would end antibiotic research and development. Other companies that haven't eliminated antibiotic R&D have significantly reduced it. In short, just as the world needs new and novel antibiotics, the research needed to find them is shrinking in size and scope. Antibiotics play a central role in modern medicine, one that goes beyond treating infections that were routinely fatal before the drugs came on the scene in the mid-20th century. The discovery of penicillin and the drugs that followed also made possible surgery, chemotherapy, dialysis, and other procedures that we now take for granted. They also help protect at-risk patients such as children, seniors, and people who have underlying conditions such as cystic fibrosis that weaken the immune system. The Pew Charitable Trusts and the Infectious Diseases Society of America, together with more than 20 leaders in antibiotic research and development, have joined forces to push for swift action in the face of growing challenges posed by the combination of increasing resistance to antibiotics and decreasing efforts to find urgently needed new antibiotics. In a letter recently sent to members of Congress, the organizations called on policymakers to commit to advancing a set of economic incentives to make antibiotic development viable again. CDC data show that tens of thousands of Americans die each year because of resistant infections. The situation could quickly become exponentially worse if new resistant mutations emerge. Indeed, Alarming new types of antibiotic resistance have recently been identified, enabling pathogens to evade some of our most powerful antibiotics and spread quickly. We cannot afford to wait or hope any longer. Congress must act now. And I'll note that in some future show, I'll talk about the issue about what a post-antibiotic world might look like. That is going to be a scary story. Okay, now for a non-commercial break featuring poetry and a call to action. That call to action is a simple act of donating blood, which on a bad day can save a life. I am a longtime blood donor. I try to give a few times each year. I'm a big fan of having skin in the game, but sometimes you have to dig even a little deeper and give up some blood. I have my 10-gallon pin from the Red Cross and the satisfaction of having saved a few lives along the way. Yet another of my unpaid gigs. So here is a poem of mine, simply entitled Blood Donor. I work 24/7, 365 days a year. I work holidays and vacations. I even work in my sleep. I am a blood donor. My work is a gift, in richness, serving what is but ours, the miracle of life, a present shared through countless vessels and singular hearts. From whence it comes, I pay it forward. I save by giving, as the circles of life grow stronger in us. For today it is my bag, and someday it may be yours. Thank you. You can clap or snap your fingers, whatever you like. Better yet, donate some blood if you can. You can call 1-800-RED-CROSS to set up an appointment or get more information about donating blood. Again, that number is 1-800-RED-CROSS or 1-800-733-2767. You're listening to WAKT We Act, 106.1 FM Toledo. If you can find a better radio station, listen to it. But remember, hear it just for the health of it. We listen, then we act. And if poetic persuasion is enough for you, here are some other facts about blood donation. Only 37% of the U.S. population is eligible to donate blood. Yes, then less than 10% actually do. One pint of blood can save up to 3 lives. Healthy adults who are at least 17 years old and at least 110 pounds may donate about a pint of blood every 2 months. There is no substitute for human blood. It has to come from our fellow humans. If only 1% more of all Americans would give blood, blood shortages would disappear. The actual blood donation usually takes about 10 minutes. The entire process from the time you sign in to the time you leave takes about an hour. And actually, for yourself as the donor, there are some health benefits. Besides the importance of purpose and connection, helping out, saving fellow human beings, having reduced iron in your body can actually be a healthy thing. As you probably, most of you are familiar with the idea of rust coming from iron, this happens a similar thing in our body. Iron is very oxidative, and this can affect seemingly both cancer and cardiovascular health. So give away. Now, back to the public health news and research roundup. In a completely unrelated story, we have a story about the adorers of the blood of Christ. From the New Yorker, the renegade nuns who took on a pipeline. In Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, they were there to protest Williams, an Oklahoma-based pipeline company that was trying to build the Atlantic Sunrise Pipeline, a 200-mile natural gas pipeline that would carry shale gas from the fields of northeastern Pennsylvania to the coast, where the fuel could be shipped abroad. The company was trying to lay the line under a cornfield belonging to the nuns, and the sisters had decided to fight back, hoping that they might draw attention to the issue of climate change. The nuns see protecting the earth as part of their religious duty. The adorers are calling for an end to the theology of human supremacy and for a deeper understanding of creation's interdependency. The adorers learned in 2015 that Williams planned to claim eminent domain in order to build a pipeline on their land. The sisters joined the protest, and in the summer of 2017 filed a lawsuit to block the company from laying the pipeline through their land on the grounds that it went against their religious beliefs. That fall, a federal court ruled against the nuns, and soon after, they lost an appeal. So, last September, they petitioned the Supreme Court to hear the case. The Adorers argued that their rights were protected under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act from 1993, which has recently been invoked in several high-profile cases. In 2014, the owners of Hobby Lobby won a Supreme Court case in which they argued that being forced to offer employees birth control violated their religious liberties. 4 years later, the court also sided with a baker in Colorado who refused to bake a cake for a gay wedding. Cases on religious liberty have tended to reinforce conservative values, but the Adorers hoped that their beliefs would also be protected. While their case wended its way through the courts, they continued protesting. They built an open-air chapel on their land along the proposed route of the pipeline to block construction. Scott Martin, a state senator who lives 2 miles down the road, had recently introduced legislation that would render protests in which people trespass near pipelines and other, quote, critical infrastructure, a felony. Of particular concern was the fact that a second new piece of legislation, which would hold protesters accountable for public fees incurred, specifically named vigils and religious services as targets. Yikes. The sisters weren't new to taking part in resistance movements. In Guatemala, some of their fellow Adorers had protested against gold mining, which damages indigenous communities and the land. Sister Aline had taken part in the civil rights movement as a young African-American woman. She had marched on the streets of Petersburg, Virginia, until the police set dogs on her and the other protesters. "This time is very much like that one," she told me. "Again, the rights of the people are being violated. Only this time, it's our religious rights in favor of the almighty dollar." In February, the Adorers learned that the Supreme Court was refusing to hear their case. The lower court's decision stood. "When I visited, construction had already been completed, and the gas was flowing beneath the outdoor chapel. Still, the nuns were proud of the stand they had taken." The Adorers are considering their next moves. Maybe they'll build a solar farm. And they suggested, make sure your Easter chocolates are fair trade. And in more decidedly good news, country winning the battle on food waste. From Seoul, South Korea, Chung Soon-hee finally crushes eggshells, dries and saves her coffee grounds, and separates large vegetable offcuts into smaller pieces. Later, the 55-year-old professional translator will bury them in her backyard in rotating plots of earth that are given ample time to compost before being replenished. She will plant tomatoes, basil, and corn in the resulting soil. Chung is one of the growing number of city dwellers who are getting into urban farming. Not just to grow their own vegetables, but also to exercise as an exercise in waste reduction. "Reducing food waste and the urban farming movements are very closely linked," said Chung, who completed a government-sponsored course 5 years ago. Her new habits reflect a larger change underway in South Korea's densely populated capital, where grassroots movements and government campaigns have dramatically transformed how people dispose of their leftover food. Once a city where unsightly and foul-smelling landfills loomed over entire neighborhoods, Seoul now operates one of the most rigorous food waste recycling programs in the world. The results have been impressive. The South Korean government banned sending food to landfills in 2015, and in 2013 also prohibited the dumping of garbage juice, leftover water squeezed from food waste, into the sea. Today, a staggering 95% of food waste is recycled, a remarkable leap from less than 2% in 1995. Since 2013, South Koreans have been required by law to discard food waste in those biodegradable bags, priced according to volume and costing the average four-person family about $6 a month. By purchasing them from the local convenience store or supermarket, residents are effectively paying a tax on their food waste up front. In Seoul, this tax pays for roughly 60% of the cost of collecting and processing the city's food waste. It's simple but brilliant. Not only does it offer incentives for you to reduce waste, it makes you confront it. Seoul is in the process of making sure all food waste eventually becomes a resource, such as fertilizer for growing food. The city handles about 60% of the food waste while private contractors pick up the rest. Once collected, the waste is shipped off to processing plants where the yellow bags are stripped off and the food slurry is squeezed to remove any liquids. A giant churn picks out any of the hard foreign objects, such as errant utensils, before the sludge is heat treated and pulverized. The resulting powder is converted into either animal feed or fertilizer. Meanwhile, the liquid squeezed from the waste is fermented into biogas or biofuel. Despite the program's success, the need to continue reducing food waste remains stark. Seoul's food wasting processing centers have recently reported large amounts of dry fertilizer stacking up unused, an indication that there is still too much waste being created. Experts, government officials, and activists alike stress the need for more fundamental measures that reduce food waste at the source. Well, we celebrate such progress. And on that note, we end our show. If you have any comments, feel free to communicate with me through WAKT@toppun.com. Again, that's WAKT@toppun.com, TOPPUN.com. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible. But in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.